As human beings, we think a lot about faces. We look at our own faces in the mirror each morning as we get ready for the day ahead, and we see countless other faces on our screens and on the streets in our everyday lives. In fact, our brains are so hardwired to think about faces that our minds can even trick us into seeing them in objects and spaces that have no faces at all. But despite how important faces are to us, are we actually any good at differentiating one face from another? Today, I'll be talking to Dr. Kay Ritchie, a senior lecturer in cognitive psychology at the University of Lincoln, who specializes in the science of face perception, to find out more about how good we really are at matching photos to faces, and how face recognition research is being applied in real-world settings. I'm Matt Young, and welcome to Spotlights.
Hello, Kay. Welcome to Spotlights Podcast. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Matt. Thanks a lot for having me. It's great to be here.
Wonderful. So glad to have you on this first series to talk all about the world of face recognition. Really excited to hear all about it. So before we dive into today's topic, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Kay Ritchie. I'm a senior lecturer in the psychology department at the University of Lincoln. And yeah, my time's split between teaching students, all the admin that comes with having an academic job, and all of my research time is spent obsessing about faces, what we do when we look at other people's faces. And most particularly, my interest is in face recognition. So how we recognize people who are familiar to us and how a face goes from being unfamiliar to familiar. So how we learn what new people look like.
So probably more than the average person would be obsessed with faces, I take it.
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes people say to me, you know, oh, would this be a good profile picture? Do I look like a nice person in this profile picture? And they kind of try and draw on my expertise when they're building, you know, like a LinkedIn profile. And so I think, yeah, probably more than the average person, I obsess about faces. Yeah.
So I think before we learn a bit more about why exactly you are obsessed with faces, what do we mean when we're talking about face recognition from a cognitive psychology perspective?
Sure. So I think the most interesting example and the easiest example to think of is thinking about photo ID. So we're really used to sort of proving our identity, proving that we are who we say we are by showing some sort of document or card that has a photo of us on it. So whether that's your driving license or your passport, you know, if you're going to pick up a parcel at the post office or you're trying to gain entry to a different country or buy age-restricted goods, you're often asked to produce some sort of document that has a photograph of you on it. And that seems to make perfect sense. So I can look at my driving license photo and say, even though it's in black and white, there's different layers of authentication. Get out your driving license photo and look at it. There's sort of layers of authentication of holograms and things covering your face. Even with all of that, I can look at that and say, yep, that's a pretty good photo of me. However, when I look at my passport photo, I don't know about anyone else, but I definitely have serial killer vibes in my passport photo. I think most people probably do. So if we think about the job of the person who's actually checking your photo ID, of course, they're doing things like if it's an age-restricted item, they're looking at your age. They're looking that the address matches the address that the parcel's been delivered to. But mostly what they're doing is looking at this photograph of you, which could be small, black and white, serial killer-esque, and they're looking at you standing in front of them, and they're trying to decide, does this photo show the same person as the person standing in front of me? And it turns out that that's actually a really difficult task. So one of the sort of central questions in my research has been, if we know that people are quite bad at recognizing an unfamiliar person in different images, then why do we rely on photo ID so much? So I think that's interesting because we kind of dupe ourselves into thinking that we're quite good at recognizing faces. So it's pretty rare that you fail to recognize a familiar person when you're walking down the street, even if it's a friend who you're not expecting to see that day. I mean, okay, it's difficult now. Nobody's walking down the street. We're not allowed out. Everyone's wearing face masks. But in normal times, when we would, you know, walk around, you recognize someone, you know, you wave to them, say hello. It's pretty rare that you wouldn't spot a familiar person. So because we're so good at recognizing familiar faces, we kind of convince ourselves that we're just excellent at face recognition in general. And so photo ID makes sense, right? I can look at this degraded or strange looking picture of me and see really quickly and obviously that it's me. Whereas if it's a photo of someone that you don't know, it turns out it's actually really difficult to say, yes, these two photographs show the same person, or yes, this photo on an ID document shows the same person who's standing in front of me. So I think our over-reliance on photo ID as a means of identity verification comes from the fact that we're really good at recognizing familiar people, and we actually don't really have a great understanding of the fact that we're not very good at recognizing unfamiliar people. And if you think about the person checking your photo ID, that person's almost always going to be unfamiliar to you. So that's where a lot of our science comes from, is trying to understand why unfamiliar face recognition is so error-prone and what we can do to improve it.
In terms of day-to-day face recognition for people, I think most people will be familiar with having had that moment with their friends or their family where they've said, oh, I recognize this person in this TV show, and they will try and look them up online, and maybe they'll realize they've been mistaken because perhaps there's one or two or three celebrities who actually look really, really similar. And when I think about my own experience with face recognition, that's a prominent example that comes to mind that I think most people will be familiar with, where we realize, oh, wait, I'm probably not as good as recognizing faces as everybody else. So it does make sense from my perspective anyway, that actually, yeah, we probably should be looking into why we use photo ID and why we assume that you putting a picture of someone's face on every single official document is the most reliable way. I was wondering if you could give us some examples as to how and maybe in what scenarios that photo ID has not really been that reliable, and why we need to be looking into face recognition and psychology behind it.
Yeah, sure. So those are all really good questions and really good points. So I guess one of the reasons why photo ID is not that reliable is exactly because of what you've described, of having the experience of some people being better at recognizing faces than others. So you might be sitting watching a TV program with your friend, and they can pick out each character, each of the previous series that person was in, and you're sitting thinking, nope, I thought that was someone else. So that is a great example of what we call like the spectrum of face recognition abilities. So in the sort of non-clinical population, most of us are all right-ish at recognizing faces. Some people are really poor. Those people are usually referred to as being prosopagnosic. It's from the Latin or Greek. Prosop refers to the face. Agnosia is not being able to recognize things. So people with prosopagnosia are either born with prosopagnosia, or they have received a brain injury that has resulted in them being less able to recognize faces than other people. And so they would be right at the bottom end of the face recognition spectrum. Most of us fall somewhere in the middle. And then at the very top end, there are people who are referred to as super recognizers. That can be a kind of misleading term, but you might have heard that term used in relation to law enforcement. So places like the Metropolitan Police Force actually employ people who they refer to as super recognizers to sort of trawl through CCTV and try and identify different criminals at different scenes, or to compare a low-grade CCTV image to previous arrest images of suspects. I said super recognizer might be a bit of a misleading term because, well, what does recognizing mean? That can be a sort of memory task. Do we mean a super matcher, so the ability to match someone in one picture to another picture, or do we mean the ability to remember them? So that's a kind of ongoing debate in the super recognizer literature. But because we have this sort of great spectrum of face recognition abilities, that's one of the explanations for why photo ID is not that useful on the large scale. So if you take, you know, a population of passport controllers, each of whose job is to look at multiple photos on passports and compare those to the faces of the travelers, multiple times an hour. There have been a few different studies done on people like passport controllers that have shown that actually, despite the fact that they receive sort of some element of training in this task, they're no better than just a general student population. The passport controllers actually don't perform any better on face matching tasks than students. A face matching task is our sort of approximation in the face recognition world to the passport control situation. So what we would do is present two images side by side and just ask you, do these two pictures show the same person or two different people? And that's our approximation of a person standing holding their photo ID in their hand. Not only do passport controllers not perform any better than students, the amount of time that they've been in the job bears no relation to their ability. So it's not like the longer people have been doing this, the better they get at it. Just some people are good, and some people aren't so good, and it has no relation to how long they've been doing that job. So that sounds a little bit frightening on the...
It does, yeah. it really does. And it actually, you know, learning about this kind of almost earth-shattering knowledge that actually we might, as everyday people, think of going to the supermarket, getting our ID checked, or, you know, going through an airport when we were allowed to travel and getting our passport checked there. We might think that looking at a picture and being able to look at the person in front of you and say, this image and this person are the same, it's just an everyday task that everybody can do. But to hear that actually it's a lot more difficult and a lot less reliable, it can bring up a lot of concerns and questions for a lot of people that actually, you know, if people don't tend to get better at this over time and it's generally not reliable, what do we do about it? And, you know, what impacts does that potentially have on us as a society?
Right. So that's a great question. And what we can do is just exploit the fact that we know that in the general population, there's quite a wide range of face recognition ability. And instead of saying, well, we'll just recruit anyone, what we should really be doing is actually screening people at the point of recruitment. So there are lots of different standardized tests of face recognition ability. And at the interview stage, if you're applying for a passport control job, if we just give you one of these tests of face recognition ability, we know kind of from the population standards what kind of average ability is. And if we want to recruit people who are a bit above average, then we can at least screen out people who are not very good at face recognition by simply administering a face recognition task at the time of recruitment. And that is actually something that our colleagues in Australia have been doing. They've been working with the Australian Passport Authority, and they do now screen anyone whose job it is to look at images of faces and make identity decisions as part of their job. They are now screened at the point of recruitment to make sure that they're getting people who are quite good at this task just sort of naturally, rather than recruiting anyone and trying to train them up.
So when you have these questions about face recognition, people's ability to recognize others' faces in various situations, what kind of questions are you as a researcher asking? Or what do you want to know in the future of face recognition research?
So the main thing that I want to know is, what is the difference? What is the sort of qualitative difference between recognizing familiar and unfamiliar people? And how does a face go from being unfamiliar to familiar? So one of the ideas behind the sort of difference between familiar and unfamiliar face recognition is just that, well, when someone's familiar to us, we've seen them look a lot of different ways, right? We've experienced what we call their within-person variability. So I've known you for, well, some time, Matt. So I've seen you change your hairstyle. I've seen you wearing different glasses. I've seen you in different lighting, different facial expressions, things like that. Whereas if someone was completely unfamiliar to me and they presented themselves at passport control, all I've got to go on is how they look now, probably tired, a bit sweaty as a traveller, and I've got this serial killer-esque passport photo in front of me. I don't know if the serial killer is the sweaty traveller because I haven't experienced all the different kinds of ways that that person can look. I haven't experienced their variability. So a while ago now, when I was working as a postdoc, we were actually really keen on exploring this, and we actually ran an experiment where we asked participants to learn what new people looked like. And for each person, they were just shown 10 images of the person, and they were told what the person's name was, and they were told, just try and remember that this is what this person looks like, and this is their name. And they were either shown 10 really different looking images of the person, where they change in age, maybe even adiposity, so they might have put on weight or lost a bit of weight, hairstyle, facial hair, facial expression, that sort of thing, as well as all the photos were taken with, you know, different cameras in different lighting situations. So you get quite a wide range of variability. For some of the other people that they were asked to learn, they were shown really similar looking pictures. So we actually just screen capped images from a video of the person talking to the camera. So now we've got the same lighting, the same camera. They can't age or change their hairstyle mid sort of conversation. So we've got a lot less variability. They can still move their head and change facial expression, but that's the only variability that you get. So you either learn people from really high variability or really low variability. And what we showed was that on lots of different sort of subsequent tests, people were better at recognizing the ones who they'd learned from the high variability set of images compared to the low variability set of images. So that kind of goes with our suggestion that the difference between familiar and unfamiliar people is the amount of variability that you've been exposed to. So the more variability, the better you learn the person. And that would come in natural familiarity simply by, you know, you've known that person for a longer time, you've seen them in different situations, so you've seen their face look different ways. So we think that that's kind of key to face learning, that you have to experience enough variability in the person.
What could people take away to be able to apply in their own lives to maybe get better at recognizing people? Or is that something we can even do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think probably I would side on the side of it's not something that we can do. So a few, there's been a few studies recently which have looked at different training programs that are given to like forensic facial examiners. So these are people who are typically employed in law enforcement, whose job it is to look at maybe a previous arrest image of a suspect and an image captured on CCTV from a crime scenario. And they painstakingly compare these two images, and they compare them sort of point by point, you know, the left eye with the left eye, the nose with the nose, etc. And they have lots of different strategies that they go through. They can take hours to compare pairs of images. And they give their responses on a scale of confidence from sort of, I'm sure these aren't the same people, to I'm sure these are the same people. Or they can decide not to make a decision. So they say, like, I'm not offering any decision on this pair. I just don't know. And there's lots of different training programs for these people. And there's been a few, again, out from the group in Australia, who we've worked quite closely with at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. They've looked at these training programs and evaluated them and tested people before they take part in the training program and then afterwards. And if there is a difference, it's a really tiny improvement that they get from going through these painstaking processes. And in some cases, for some of the training programs, there's just no improvement. So it might give the sort of false impression to the forensic facial examiners that, well, they've been trained, so they must be quite good at this now. But in actual fact, they're not really getting much better at the task. So based on that, I would probably suggest that we don't yet know how we can just improve anyone's facial recognition ability. But what we do know is that some people might be just quite a bit better than others.
You mentioned that passport controllers are people who look at faces a lot in a professional setting. But as many people who have traveled in recent years will know that the use of e-gates, the use of automatic computer-based face recognition, is becoming a lot more popular at airports around the world. How does your research in the world of face recognition play into the world of automated face recognition?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the first thing to say is that any system that uses automatic face recognition, there is always a human input, right? So all of these systems require human verification at some point. So in the case of e-gates, if it decides that you are not the person pictured in your passport, the decision is then bumped on to a human to then look at the image that's been captured of you at e-gate and the image in your passport and decide if you're the right person. In terms of law enforcement, a few different police forces in the UK are using automatic face recognition software. And also around the world, it's more common in Australia, I think, than it is here. But again, those systems have a human element to them. So you'll input your question image, say a CCTV image of someone's face when they're committing a crime. And the algorithm will search through its database of, in the US, it might be state driving licenses, or in the UK, it would be specifically people on a watch list. So criminals who are on a watch list for this type of crime. And the algorithm will decide, right, here's the top 200 or 500 or 20 faces from the database that I think match that CCTV image. And again, it's over to the human to decide which of those 20 might actually show the suspect. So there's always a kind of human element to it. I am really interested in automatic face recognition for a couple of reasons. It's massively improving. It's so impressive how quickly these systems are improving. So in the past 10 years, systems have gone from being far less accurate than humans to far more accurate than humans ever could be, it's particularly on high quality images. So we now see typically the best algorithms outperforming humans on lots of different image conditions, but particularly sort of high quality images. So that's really interesting that the technology just keeps getting better. And that's because of the introduction people might have heard of deep neural networks. So this is a way of training the computer essentially trains itself. It's a black box system. It learns how to recognize faces, and we don't really know how it does it. So I imagine it's sort of like Magic Pixies. It's probably Magic Pixies, but
only mildly terrifying. Only mildly terrifying to consider.
Right. The fact is, we can't interrogate the system to find out what it's doing. But whatever it's doing it well. So that's one thing to note, that the systems really are improving a great deal. However, that kind of opens up their use in lots of different situations, like law enforcement in the criminal justice system. And actually, we don't have good legislation around the use of automatic face recognition. We don't have codes in the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. There isn't a clear guide for how the police should be using automatic face recognition. There isn't a clear legislation on how automatic face recognition evidence can be considered in courts or in the criminal justice system. And fundamentally, we don't really understand what people think about it. How do people feel about potentially walking down the street and being enrolled into a biometric database as they're going about their business? And so that is the focus of a piece of work that I'm doing at the moment, which is funded by the British Academy. And that's taking place here at Lincoln and with colleagues at the University of New South Wales in psychology and in law, where we're just asking, you know, what is the public understanding of automatic face recognition? How do people feel about it? And who do they trust to use it? And we're asking that question in different countries around the world. So keep an eye out for that. Hopefully we'll have more to say on that once that project's complete. But I do think it's really important for vendors and for users of technology to understand what the public know and how the public feel about its use, whether it's from the point of view of then wanting to correct any myths that are going about or help people to use technology. I think it's important that first, before we sort of roll out these systems, hoping that there'll be a sort of panacea and sort of fix all of our problems with face recognition, first of all, we really ought to understand how the general public actually feels about that. And so that's what our latest research is focusing on.
Thank you so much, Kay, for giving us such a well-rounded introduction into the world of face recognition. I was wondering if there's anywhere else that our listeners could go today if they want to find out a bit more about face recognition and, you know, some of the work you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably the best place for quite a nice kind of introduction to the kind of stuff we've been talking about today would be a magazine article that myself and my colleague Robin Kramer wrote a few years ago now. And we actually wrote the magazine article to accompany a piece of research we'd done around how small changes to images can kind of be devastating to our ability to recognize people. And the example we gave there was glasses. So simply putting a pair of glasses on one picture makes it really hard to determine whether two pictures show the same person or not. So the kind of fun analogy we went for there was Superman, right? He's famous for this glasses disguise. And you think, how silly is that? Lois must be able to recognize that Clark wearing a pair of glasses is the same as Superman.
Well, actually, we've all thought that. We all shout, anyone who's seen Superman has shouted at the TV being like, it's just the same man, but with glasses.
Well, he also, I think, turns his quiff the other way in some of the comics. But anyway, the glasses disguise maybe isn't so ridiculous based on some of our findings. So we wrote a magazine article.
Yeah, we'll link to that in the episode description.
Brilliant. And it's called Why and How Superman Hides Behind Glasses. So if you give that a bit of a read, it'll tell you about that specific piece of research, but also a little bit more about face recognition in general. And it would be remiss of me before I go not to mention my other role within the university, which
is
city leader for Lincoln for Pint of Science. So Pint of Science is a science festival which takes place in pubs, sort of fun science talks in pubs. Obviously, due to the pandemic, we are in virtual pubs at the moment. But if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, then please do have a look at pintofscience.co.uk, and details of the festival, which will be up and running again in May, will be available there.
Wonderful. Very exciting. And I'm sure we can look forward to hearing loads more from yourself and all sorts of other interesting people at university at that later this year.
Yep. Brilliant. Thank you, Matt.
Brill. Thanks for joining us, Kay. It's been great to have you.
Thanks for having me. It's been super to be here.
Spotlights is produced by me, Matt Young, for the University of Lincoln in association with Siren Radio. To learn more, visit spotlights.blogs.lincoln.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.